Good evening. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, 12 mine workers die. Where was the Mine Safety Administration?
And first, we have so many battles, and one of the battles is there is this tipping point now, the 5-4 possibility, the Alito nomination, which looms large, and with us to help us understand the myriad issues that are in front of us is Elliot Meisenberg, who is with People for the American Way. Elliot, what's at stake here?
There's no question that there is a huge amount at stake here. We're talking about somebody to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who has been the swing vote on what is very often a 5-4 court on issue after issue. Reproductive rights, affirmative action, the environment, the ability of Congress to pass laws that protect citizens' health and safety and civil rights. On all these issues, the court is very closely divided. And Alito's record shows that he would move the court far to the right. One prominent scholar said that if Alito were confirmed, there would be nobody to the right of Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court. That puts him right there with Scalia and Thomas, some of those dangerous justices that we now have on the Supreme Court. So there is a huge amount at stake in this situation.
Well, let's try to parse out some of the issues. Let's tackle executive power, which has been on my mind a little bit in the last day, as we find out that the president has 30 times extended buying apparatus on U.S. citizens. Where would we place Alito in the issue of, for example, executive power?
Alito could potentially be very dangerous in that area. Again, O'Connor's been a very important voice. She was the one who wrote just a few years ago that a state of war is not a blank check for the president to take away citizen liberties. But Alito has said that he's a believer in something called the unitary executive, which has been a key theory that the Bush people have used to argue that the president has all executive power, and that executive power is quite large and extreme. And it's more than theory. Alito has, for example, in one case directly involving government intrusion of the right to privacy, the police in one case executed a strip search of a mother and her 10-year-old daughter, even though the search warrant they had didn't allow them to search anybody other than the owner of the apartment. They brought a case to vindicate their civil rights. Alito said they had no such rights, that it was just a little technicality that the warrant had named them. Of all people, our current director of Homeland Security, then Judge Michael Chertoff, wrote the majority opinion disagreeing with Alito and saying that Alito's view would essentially turn the search warrant requirement into little more than a rubber stamp. Another case, when he was in the Solicitor General's office, that he thought would be okay and wouldn't even raise constitutional issues for Tennessee to enforce a statute that allowed police officers to shoot to kill unarmed people leaving the scene of a robbery, something that was disagreed with by all 9 Supreme Court justices and every police organization that filed a brief in that case. So there are a couple of examples, and there are unfortunately many more, where Alito has deferred to executive and police authority. And with his endorsement of this unitary executive theory, I think we're very concerned that Alito could very well be a vote to uphold these kinds of incredible assertions of power that the Bush administration has been engaged in. Certainly, it's true that if a filibuster is appropriate to prevent a 4-year extension of the Patriot Act, it clearly has to remain on the table when you're talking about putting somebody on the Supreme Court who's likely to be there for 30 years or more and can have an enormous impact on our basic rights and liberties.
Elliot, let's tackle another issue, particularly for Ken. Let's look at the issue of job suits and the power of corporations versus the worker. How would they fare with an Alito Supreme Court justice?
There was an article just a few weeks ago in the New York Times that pointed out that businesses are solidly behind Alito, and they rejoice when they see him on a court panel that's considering one of their cases. And in fact, that is borne out by his record, particularly in divided cases, cases where that aren't easy, where there may be a difference of opinion between the judges. He is almost uniformly in those kinds of cases involving job discrimination and other issues sided against workers and for big corporations. One case, there were the whole Third Circuit, which is the circuit that Alito is on, considered whether a sex discrimination plaintiff had proven enough evidence just to get her case to a jury. Not to win, but just to have a jury consider the case. 10 of the judges ruled that she had enough evidence to do that. Only one ruled that she didn't and her case should be thrown out. Guess who that one was? Could it be Sam Alito? O'Connor's conservative, no question about it. But again, in that area too, she was often the fifth or sometimes the sixth vote in key cases. Affirmative action is one example of that, where she was the fifth vote that saved affirmative action in the University of Michigan case from being thrown out completely just a couple of years ago.
A lot of people seem to think that the president should have his way on the Supreme Court nomination unless the nominee is totally not up to the task professionally or totally beyond the pale in some kind of way. Is that what you think?
Absolutely not. And it really reflects a total misunderstanding of the genius of our founding fathers. They realized they were putting judges on the Supreme Court for life. That's a tremendous amount of authority and power. And there's good reason for that, because you want them to be independent and isolated from politics. But if that's going to happen, the only way to make it work is by both the other two branches operating through checks and balances to have a co-equal role in the selection. So the president nominates with the advice and the consent of the Senate. Didn't seek much advice in the case of Alito other than from the far right. From what we know, the only people that he consulted with after they got rid of Harriet Myers and insisted on somebody like Alito instead. But historically, it's always been the case that the Senate has often rejected presidential nominations because they disagree with the views of those nominees. One of the very first nominees by George Washington to the Supreme Court was rejected because senators didn't like his view of the Jay Treaty with England, much less of a kind of a legal issue that's likely to come before the Supreme Court. We have many examples through history where nominees of presidents were not approved for exactly that reason. What we should have when we get to the Supreme Court is consensus. That's what Bill Clinton did when he picked Ruth Bader Ginsburg and when he picked Justice Breyer. While the right likes to caricature them now, at the time their record was quite clear. They were reasonably middle of the road, and in fact, Orrin Hatch, who was the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, at a time when the Republicans had fewer senators than the Democrats do now, actually recommended Ginsburg and Breyer as consensus nominees who could and did get through. That's not what this president did. This president instead chose to do what he too often does, to confront, to play to his far-right base. And moderates, Republicans as well as Democrats in the Senate, have every right, and I would argue an obligation, to stand up to that.
Well, I would certainly also argue that there's a threat to 70 years of social progress in the area of workers' rights and civil rights and privacy and choice and reproductive freedom and public safety, just to name a few. What about Congress's authority to protect Americans? Eroded, maintained with an Alito?
Another area where I think we have a lot to worry about. Back in 1985, Alito filled out what was in essence a job application for Ed Meese to get a political position in the Justice Department. And in that, he touted some of his right-wing credentials and beliefs. And one of those was a strong belief in what he called limited government and federalism. And he even took this to the point that before he became a judge, he recommended that President Reagan veto a federal law that was there to protect against crooked odometers from used car salesmen. And the reason for that was federalism. After all, he said, it's the states and not the federal government that are supposed to protect the health and welfare and safety of their citizens. A very chilling view. And he's going forward with that as a federal judge. The most two very quick infamous cases that I'll mention, he ruled that application of the medical leave provisions of the Family Medical Leave Act to state employees was unconstitutional. And here's the one that I find the most out of the mainstream. The Third Circuit considered whether it was constitutional under the Commerce Clause for Congress to pass a limitation on the possession and transfer of machine guns. Put aside gun control. This wasn't a Second Amendment case. The question was whether Congress just had the power under the Commerce Clause to do that, a very important power that's used as the basis for most of our environmental laws, many of our civil rights laws. Five federal courts of appeals had already ruled that, of course, Congress had that power, even after a recent decision of the Supreme Court in something called the Lopez case. And the majority of the Third Circuit agreed with that, too. So that's six. Alito again dissented and argued that that law passed by Congress was unconstitutional. Severe criticism by the other judges on his court for very good reason, because it would really threaten the ability of Congress to pass all sorts of laws that protect the environment, civil rights, health, and safety.
We've got to get cracking. We've got to oppose this nomination. If you want more information, you can go to the website of People for the American Way.
I urge your listeners across the region, and I have to single out the state of Connecticut, where the senators haven't really announced which way they're leaning, to do everything you can to urge your senators to vote no on Alito.
Well, we've been speaking with Elliot Meisenberg, Senior Vice President and Legal Director of People for the American Way and Chair of the Research Committee. It has been a pleasure.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sick of the safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die. Now, I don't want your chemicals clouding my brain. I want to keep all of my fingers and toes.
The tragic death of 12 miners at the Sego mine wasn't really an accident. While Sego had a history of serious safety violations, the mine owners have escaped significant fines. Workplace fatalities are rarely accidents. They usually occur when inspection and enforcement of health and safety hazards in the workplace have been eroded over a long period. Yet the Mine Safety Administration virtually disappeared during the crisis and now plans to investigate only the explosion, but not the events leading up to it. Tony Uppegard is former general counsel of the Kentucky Department of Mines, joins us.
Tony, let's start with the crisis itself. I have questions about how long it took the rescue team to get there, and also who was handling the crisis. Was it the Mine Safety Administration or was it the employer? We only heard from the employer.
It's really a combination of both. When there's a disaster like this, MSHA, that's the Mine Safety and Health Administration, will take charge over the mine. They are in control, and they get feedback and input from the coal operator and also from the state regulatory agency, but essentially MSHA's in charge.
It didn't appear that way from the way we were getting information during the crisis, and also what took so long for the rescue team to get there?
The answer to your first part of the question is that MSHA didn't do a very good job at public relations during the disaster. My understanding is that they had a couple people from their press office present at the mine site, but they did not update the families about what was going on, and they certainly didn't have any type of presence on the TV coverage. I think that was a public relations mistake on their part. The more important question about what took so long for the mine rescue teams to get there is really a breakdown in the whole structure of mine rescue in the United States. About 25, 30 years ago, there was a lot more mine rescue teams than there are today. A lot of individual mines had mine rescue teams. And really, coal operators have gotten away from that because they don't want to pay the costs associated with it. which I might add really are not all that substantial when you consider the benefits of having an early response. Mine rescue teams under federal law do have to train every other month in a mine to keep their skills sharp, to make sure that their apparatuses, that's the breathing devices, are in good working order, et cetera. Nowadays, there just aren't enough mine rescue teams to go around. For instance, in the state of Kentucky, which I'm most familiar with, our state inspectors are the mine rescue teams. We have six offices throughout the state. Every mine has to have a mine rescue team with at least within 2 hours. And that's the federal law also, that there has to be a mine rescue team within 2 hours of each mine. But it's really something that needs to be examined in public hearings, why we didn't have a faster response, why it would take so many hours to get mine rescue teams to the mine. And we really need to get back to what was done in the older days of having mine rescue teams at every mine that of some size. One last thing I might add about that, one of the regulations that was being worked on when the Clinton administration left office was a regulation to bolster mine rescue teams in this country. And when the Bush administration took over, they scrapped that regulation and just threw it in the garbage can.
Since October, the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration issued no less than 50 citations at the non-union, we should say at the non-union, Sago Mine in central West Virginia. The penalties, the consideration of the dangerous conditions that are just inherent in mine work, seem not to be addressed in any meaningful way.
You're right when you say that mining is inherently dangerous. Most coal mines in central Appalachia are low-seam coal mines, so frequently they're working on their knees. My understanding of the Sago mine was that the seam was about 5 feet, so still miners can't stand up. They have to duck walk in the mine, that is, crouched over. And miners have very small margin of error in the mines. You're working in a dark atmosphere that's noisy because of mechanized equipment. There's not much room to get around, so the smallest mistake can cost you your life, could cost you a limb. Those are the inherent dangers, but if a mine is safely operated, those inherent dangers can be reduced quite a bit. If you have combustible materials, loose coal, float coal dust, laying around, you're increasing the chance of an explosion. And those are the types of conditions that are intolerable. There's no need for them to exist. There's already enough dangers in the mine without sloppy housekeeping making the mine more dangerous. It's unusual to go to a mine and not find any violations. However, the record that Sago had was less than enviable. I believe last year they had over 200 violations. 92 were what we call S&S, that's significant and substantial. Even more importantly, they had 16 unwarrantable failures. What that means is, under the federal law, unwarrantable failure to comply with the safety regulations, that means that it's either a knowing violation, the operator knew it existed and didn't correct it, or it's so obvious that they should have known about it. It means an indifference to mine safety or an extreme lack of care. So when you see that MSHA had issued 15 or 16 unwarrantable failures at that mine, what that tells me is that MSHA knew they had a problem mine. Now, as for union versus non-union, I don't think there's any question that union mines are safer than non-union mines. That's not to say that you can't have an explosion at a union mine, because the Jim Walter Resources explosion in September of 2001, that was a union mine in Alabama. However, as a general rule, you have more safety rights at a union mine, you have a voice at a union mine, and when you work at a non-union mine, your miners really don't have a voice. It's more difficult to complain about safety. They still have the federal right of under Section 105C of the Mine Act to complain about safety and even to refuse to work in unsafe conditions. If a miner, for instance, is told to work without ventilation curtains being hung, which would pose an explosion hazard and also increase the risk of getting black lung disease, the miner could refuse to work. And if he's discriminated against, either discharged or otherwise, he can file a discrimination complaint with MSHA. They'll investigate it, and if they believe that the law has been violated, they'll give the miner an attorney to litigate and try to get his job back. But you see, the choice that a miner is faced with is really a Hobson's choice. Do Do I accept unsafe working conditions to try to keep my job and risk my life, or do I go ahead and complain, in which case I'll get fired, and it'll take a year or 2 years to litigate it? And when you work and live in Appalachia, where there really aren't that many job opportunities, they really don't have a whole lot of choice. They may be out of work for a year if they lose their job, and there just are not that many good-paying jobs in Appalachia. Coal mining is the best-paying job that you're going to find.
But though the Mine Safety Administration did find 200 violations, I think, in the last year, the fines were only like $24,000 or something. Is this really deterrent? What's been happening to them?
In a lot of cases, it's not. The fines, it's been reported that this same operator, that's International Coal Group, they had a fatality in Kentucky in 2005, and it was at a processing plant where a miner was struck by some slurry that had frozen, and I believe the line broke and struck him and killed him. And the operator really didn't have delineated procedures on how you should handle these slurry lines. It's sad to say, and it's really amazing, but they were assessed a fine of, it was $440, which of course outraged the miner's family.
What has happened such that we can't get the fines? I know that one thing, for example, in the Bush administration, their main attention to the coal industry seems to have been to appoint really political appointees directly from energy corporations to sit in regulatory posts. That probably has something to do with the penalties.
Well, they not only filled the political positions with people from industry, they also got some industry folks into the career jobs. Some of the more important career jobs, they got those people into MSHA, and, you know, they're going to be there for years to come. They won't leave when the administration leaves. But the philosophy under the Bush administration for mine safety, and this isn't opinion, I mean, this is what they would say in speech after speech, is that they believed in compliance assistance. And what that meant was that they did not want inspectors to be confrontational or adversarial when they went in the mines. They wanted them to spend more time walking and talking with mine operators, trying to explain to them how they can better comply with the law. The Bush philosophy was that, you know, coal operators are all good guys. If you tell them what they're doing wrong, then they'll correct it, take care of it, and history has proven that's not true. I mean, we all know that there's good operators out there, but we also know that there's outlaw operators. You know, an outlaw operator, you have to use all your enforcement tools. That clearly has not been done under this administration. The number of criminal prosecutions are down. The special investigations, those are investigating coal miner safety discrimination cases, those are down. The seriousness attached to citations are down.
So what happens next? Is there an investigation as to how this happened and what should be done to prevent it in the future?
I've called, actually, and for MSHA to hold public hearings in this case. And under Section 103B of the mine law, they can do that. Now, there's only been one public hearing held by MSHA in the last 28 years. That was in 1999 in Louisiana, and actually I participated in that one when I worked for MSHA. I was advised that the governor of West Virginia today has announced that West Virginia is going to hold a public hearing. Now, my understanding, typically the state and the federal will do a joint investigation. My understanding from talking to a reporter from the Charleston Gazette tonight is that a question was asked at the news conference if MSHA is going to invoke the section of the law that gives them subpoena power. And they were told no, that they're going to participate in this public hearing with the state of West Virginia, but they're not going to invoke their subpoena power. That's troubling on a couple different levels. One is that obviously you cannot compel people to testify if you don't have subpoena power. And I'm not certain at this point whether or not the state of West Virginia does have subpoena power. Nonetheless, on the whole, I think it's a good development because my understanding is that the families will be allowed to ask questions at the public hearing. And typically in MSHA investigations, the interviews are done behind closed doors. And hard as it may be to believe, and it's something I've been arguing against for 20 years, the coal company and their attorney are allowed to be present at these interviews, and the families are not. And witnesses are typically told it's a voluntary interview, and you have the right to terminate the interview at any time, and you have the right to refuse to answer any question that you don't want to answer. And I think it's pretty obvious that's not a very good investigation technique. Holding public hearings is just good government. Let's get them out in the sunlight. Let's let people hear what's being said. And the most important issue, I think, is that the focus of the public hearing should not just be on the narrow issue of what caused this mine explosion. In other words, what was the point of origin? What was the ignition source? Rather, we should be examining issues such as why do self-contained self-rescuers, that's the breathing device that miners have, why does it only hold 1 hour's worth of oxygen? Why not 5 hours' worth of oxygen? Why are there so few mine rescue teams? Why does MSHA not require atmospheric monitoring systems in all mines? Why does MSHA not require state-of-the-art communication systems in all mines? Why does MSHA not require stoppings? Those are ventilation partitions that separate fresh air from contaminated air. Why do they not require them to be more substantially built so that they're not destroyed in an explosion? In this case, the communications, for instance, is a really important question because most mines just have a simple telephone wire with a speakerphone hooked to the end. It's really just a cable, and if you have an explosion, it's blown out. And I think had the miners in the Sago mine, had they had access to a state-of-the-art communication system, they could have called outside. They could have learned that there was no mine fire, that there was no roof fall blocking their exit from the mine, and that they possibly could have made it outside. They still would have had to gone through contaminated air, you know, that's toxic with carbon monoxide, but they did have their one-hour breathing devices. We know that. And we also know that the crew that was coming in immediately after the crew that ended up being killed, when the explosion occurred, they were able to exit the mine. They went a little further, and they knew that there was carbon monoxide, and they turned around and went back outside, and they made it out okay. And I have to think that had there been a state-of-the-art communication system in this mine, that these miners might have made it out safely. And that's another issue that needs to be examined in these hearings.
Well, you've ended on the most important point. Well, this is gut-wrenching. All these things have to be ferreted out, and we're going to do a lot more programming to see how these hearings turn out. And we thank you for your diligence and for the information that you provided us with. We've been speaking with Tony Appegard, former general counsel for the Kentucky Department of Mines. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.